77 WABC. The following program does not necessarily reflect the views of WABC Radio.
The following program is brought to you by NYU Winthrop Hospital. It's the weekend. Be good to yourself. It's Katz's Corner with Dr. Aaron Katz, where you get simple, straightforward answers to your questions about health, from diet and supplements to lifestyle changes. To reach Dr. Katz, call 800-848-WABC. Now, live on 77 WABC, it's the chairman of urology at NYU Winthrop Hospital in New York. Here is Dr. Aaron Katz.
Good morning. This is not Dr. Aaron Katz. My name is Dr. Kevin Marzo, and I'm the guest host today. Good morning, everybody. I am filling in for Dr. Katz. I am a cardiovascular specialist, a cardiologist, and I'm at NYU Winthrop Hospital. And my topic today is high blood pressure, hypertension, the silent killer. I chose this topic because it probably impacts every patient I take care of in a cardiovascular practice. And my special guest today is also a colleague, Navit Masani. He is a nephrologist. A nephrologist is a kidney specialist. And the reason I chose him is a guest. He's an expert in hypertension. And the two systems, the heart and the kidney, are closely related. So I'll be discussing with him hypertension, high blood pressure. Hypertension, I think, is really a challenging disease to treat. It's so common. No one really feels it most of the time. And when you go to a doctor, you get a blood pressure, and often the first thing, your first reaction is, oh, I'm just nervous. Right now, my blood pressure is high. I left the morning expecting to be here at 7:45. An Uber cab decided to drive at 25 miles an hour in the right lane. If I took a blood pressure, I'm sure it was elevated. I didn't have a high salt load today, and right now I'm starting to calm down. So, again, welcome. Dr. Masani, are you there?
I'm here. Well, thanks, Dr. Marzo. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so what is high blood pressure? So it's something that I think since the first days of my medical school training, we've used the number 120 over 80. And I think this is still pretty consistent. Navi, would you agree? What are the blood pressure goals or targets that you think that you should say Americans should have?
I mean, I think that for the most part, those numbers are still fairly consistent in that once you start getting over 130 over 80, that's where you start getting into that pre-hypertension world. Certainly over 140 over 90, you need to be treated.
So if you see someone in the office and their blood pressure, they walk in and it's 150 over 100, what do you say?
Well, I think first the first thing that you want to do, and Dr. Marzo, you alluded to this, is just to settle down. Just to settle down, have a conversation. Make it a back and forth. One size does not fit all. You want to talk about things like diet and lifestyle. You mentioned salt. There has been so much controversy about salt over the past few years. Granted, not everyone in the world needs to be on a low-salt diet. If you have hypertension, you need to be on a low-salt diet. So that's one of the first things that we try and have a conversation about.
So So what's so bad about hypertension? Well, first thing, it's causes kidney problems, it causes heart problems, it's a major risk factor for stroke. In the United States, I think the estimate is that more than 50% of Americans over the age of 50 develop high blood pressure, and by the age of 80, it may be closer to 80 to 90%. I think when we're looking at people's blood pressure, one is, what is it, how do you measure it, what is the goals? So how would you recommend for someone who is seeing a doctor and they say, well, your blood pressure is a little elevated today, I think we should monitor it. How should they monitor it, and what are the suggestions, like from home blood pressure monitoring to some early lifestyle changes?
Yeah, I think the key to all of this is to keep it very practical and to get trends. You don't want to act on one single reading or one single number. And what you want to do, what I tell my patients is, get an upper arm blood pressure cuff. Keep it in your nightstand. Very simple. Keep it in your nightstand. Take it one morning when you wake up. Take it the following evening before you go to bed. And monitor it and track it. And you need to watch your blood pressure 3 to 4 times a week, in my mind. What you don't want to do is to be taking it 3 to 4 times a day. And just that act of taking your blood pressure, driving up your blood pressure. which is a kind of pattern that some people get into. And you want to say to them, listen, we want to take this number down over time. Take it down over time, get the trends, and also check your blood pressure if you're not feeling well, if you're having symptoms of headaches or blurry vision or trouble breathing. Then you want to make sure that your blood pressure isn't part of the problem there.
Okay, so the target blood pressure will say 120 over 80, 130 over 80, and there are certain conditions where those numbers may be even more important. If you have established heart disease, you've had a heart attack, you've had a stent, you've had a bypass, you've had a stroke, or you have some kidney problems. So when I see a patient in the office, I'll walk in the room and I'll see a blood pressure that's often monitored or measured by a medical assistant or a nurse. And the first thing I do is I tell the person, I said, calm down, relax, let's repeat it. And also find out, you know, break down some of the barriers. I'll say, Mr. and Mrs. Jones, tell me about your trip. And if they say that they just spent 45 minutes in the right lane trying to get into a 7 o'clock meeting, and say, you know, calm down, we'll see how it is in five or 10 minutes. The next question I'll ask them, what'd you have for dinner last night? And it's kind of ironic that I would say that a quarter of the patients that I talk to, and I measure their blood pressure, and I say, what'd you have last night? And she says, well, last night was different. I had a special occasion. I had 3 orders of Chinese food. I had leftover Chinese for breakfast. I just had a salted bagel. And that gives me a snapshot. One is that they're stressed. They've had a salt load. And two, they need to make some changes. So how do you educate patients on, let's say, salt? I mean, because it is a key component to contributing to blood pressure.
Absolutely, 100%. And I think the starting point with the salt conversation in my mind has to be, first and foremost, don't add salt. Salt is everywhere. It's stored in everything. It's added to everything already. First of all, get rid of your own table salt. Second of all, you're going to eat out. Certainly enjoy it. We all want to make that. We don't want to take that away. Be a little bit more selective, but be also cognizant that when you do eat out, you're likely getting a salt load in, whether it's Chinese, pizza, Italian, whatever that food product is, it's likely salt loaded. So just to educate and then bring that not level down a notch. And then finally, when you're cooking at home, try and move that salt down and use other spices to try and create a taste flavor so that you're not so stuck in your diet.
I find it very challenging, though, the recommendations that if you have high blood pressure or pre-high blood pressure or concerns about high blood pressure, to keep it under 2,500 milligrams a day. That's a tough number for a layperson to understand. So that's roughly a teaspoon of salt in all your food. You go to a barbecue, you have a hot dog with a roll and some ketchup. You probably have about 1,200 milligrams of salt. There's no label on the hot dog. How does the person who is trying to restrict salt really, when they take the salt shaker away, how do they do that? It's very difficult.
I agree with you. I don't think there's any question how difficult it is. And I think the thing that we have to remember as physicians and to educate our patients is that, number one, you can't do it overnight. If you've been on a high salt diet all your life, which, to put this into perspective, the average person's salt load is about 8 grams or 8,000 milligrams. Most people who are not paying attention to this are taking about 8,000 milligrams. So when you talk about getting down to 2,500 milligrams, A, it's challenging. B, even if you go down to half of that, you're down to 4,000 already. So reading labels, having realistic goals, and understanding that you want to achieve this over time. This is not an overnight project. You simply can't make these changes overnight. We don't want to control your blood pressure overnight. We don't want to get you from 150 over 100 to 120 over 80 overnight. As a patient, you'll feel way too many symptoms. So that it's a work in progress, so to speak.
So I agree with you, and I try to get a snapshot into people's lifestyle. I ask them when I see them, I said, tell me about your last 3 meals. Begin to see how much they understand. And then they say, and again, I'm not a nutritionalist, but I sort of give them the recommendation. I said, one, you can't add salt. Start with that. Two, start to understand what's in your food. I mean, if you go to a restaurant, you have no control. So they generally do like to sell their product. They're going to add salt. the more that you do your own cooking at home, the more natural, the more vegetable-based, the less salt you're going to have. And I think you could really change your palate to get, you know, to get to the point where you don't need to have the shaker at your bedside, and to have a diet that is basically approaching that number that may be able to contribute to lowering your blood pressure without medications. But once you get identified with high blood pressure, with all the good behavior, you just may either just have the genetics for high blood pressure. You may have some changes that you just can't reverse immediately in terms of being overweight, having bad sleep apnea. All those things will take time to improve. So then it's the time for medications. And many patients are very, very reluctant to start medications or have additional medications added to their regimen. So when you're encountering a patient and the topic about it's time for a medication, you've seen on a couple occasions, both on their home blood pressure monitor and the office measurements, that their blood pressure is above that 130, 140 over 90 range, how do you initiate medical therapy?
Yeah, and I think here, too, is the individualization is very important, the conversation with the patient in front of you, and to say, again, one size does not fit all, and to say, okay, it's time to initiate some medicines, and you want to have a conversation about the medicines because medicines have side effects. And I think patients are always concerned about those, physicians are concerned, and you need to take the time to have that conversation and say, okay, we're going to start here. And I think the key to understanding this is that one medicine may not do it, and that you need multiple medicines usually to get the blood pressure down. That is part of the package. There is something called resistant hypertension, which about a third of people with hypertension may have, where you need more than three drugs to control the blood pressure. So setting the expectations that one drug may not accomplish the goal is very important, I think. Which drug? Again, one size doesn't fit all. And you want to say to the patient, look, let's look at the person in front of you, and let's say what fits best for them. If they're a diabetic, for example, the drugs that end in pril or sartan, like lisinopril or losartan, those might be better options.
So the so someone comes in and you have a shared decision between you and the patient, deciding it's time to be treated, to take a particular medication, and then you generally use a stepwise approach. You start one medication, see their response, describe the potential side effects of that medication, begin to adopt some of the lifestyle changes that I think that all of us agree can reduce blood pressure. Those lifestyle changes are weight loss, reduce alcohol intake, no smoking, reduce your salt intake, you know, stress management. I mean, stress is clearly a component of high blood pressure, and in the world we live in, with having breaking news every 2 seconds on TV, and having a device in our hand constantly showing us what's happening, someone talking to us. So I think our stress levels in society are going up exponentially. So you try to address all those, and despite that, many patients do need more than one blood pressure, and then you start a second medication. I often tell patients, you know, with the lifestyle changes that they make, you can de-escalate, you can reduce medication. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. Just because you're on one, two, or three medications, you can potentially get off some of those.
Absolutely, and I can't stress that enough with you, and I think that you hit on something big, the smoking. If there's smoking and you stop, that's huge. In fact, it's probably bigger than giving a medication. The effect of stopping smoking is bigger than giving a medication. Treating sleep apnea, if you have sleep apnea, that's the equivalent to taking a medicine. And finally, exercise. You know, we've touched on so many things about lifestyle. Exercise, get moving. It has a huge impact on your health, even if it doesn't directly lead to weight loss. The way your blood vessels respond to exercise, there's no medication like it.
Okay. Navit, I'm going to see whether we have any callers.
Okay.
The one of the questions that's coming up is white coat hypertension, white coat high blood pressure. And the... I mean, the What do you think of that? Is it a real phenomena that your blood pressure in the doctor's office is 170 over 80, and someone comes in with a diary saying their blood pressures are 120 over 70, 140 over 80, 130 over 70? What do you say about that?
Yeah, so first of all, it is a very real problem. It is a common problem. Patients' blood pressures can be up to 20 points higher in their doctor's office, and you take a strategy where you try and let them sit for a little bit. You say, okay, I'll shut the lights off, take a few minutes, and you try and give 5-10 minutes apart for a couple of blood pressure readings. Here's the problem. The white coat hypertension does signify an increased risk, so it can't be ignored. It's not that that blood pressure, you know, the feeling becomes, oh, doctor, when I go home, it's all fine. Yeah, but the fact that you're 20 points higher in a situation like this, that is a signal for increased risk. Treating that is challenging because frequently when we work on that number, the patient goes home and they feel it. They feel lightheaded because you dropped their pressure too much. So what we try and do in that situation is, again, individualize, work with the patient. Maybe you'll use shorter acting medications so that there's time for a bit of a rebound effect so their blood pressure doesn't go as low. We use lighter doses of other multiple medications, but you have to tailor the regimen to the person in front of you, taking those things into account.
Okay, thank you, Naveed. Callers, if you want to call in, our number you know is 1-800-848-9222. The other thing that often comes up when I speak to patients is, you know, medications that could actually elevate blood pressure. And when someone provides a list of their medications they're taking, there's often about 3-4 medications that they don't consider medications, whether they're over-the-counter medications, cold medications, allergy medications, and probably one of the biggest culprits is medications for aches and pains, the anti-inflammatories or the non-steroidals, going by the names, again, Motrin, Aleve, Advil, which are very effective in taking care of your aches and pains and can really change your life, but they do have effects on blood pressure. Naveed, do you want to comment about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We see this a lot, and I think one of the things that happens is that we forget to ask patients about these medicines because they're not prescription medicines. But the amount of Advil, Motrin, Aleve, ibuprofen use out there. And so to be clear, Tylenol does not increase your blood pressure. Tylenol does not. But Advil, Motrin, Aleve certainly does. Prednisone, which is a prescription medicine, increases your blood pressure. You mentioned allergy medication. Anything containing a D, so if it's Allegra D or Claritin D, that D increases your blood pressure. And what will happen is you'll see someone who's pre-hypertension. They've always been 134 over 82 in that window area, and they take an Advil or a Motrin, or they get a sinus infection, and they take an Allegra D. And next thing you know, that blood pressure is 160 over 90. So medications prescribed and over-the-counter have to be talked about as part of the strategy here.
Great. I also find that when you give a patient a recommendation for a home blood pressure monitor, sometimes you have to really give clear instructions. So if you're going to, and I think it's extremely important for patients to, you know, take some role in their blood pressure monitoring. So how would you tell a patient to go buy a monitor, which one to use, the wrist, the arm, the finger, etc.?
Yeah, I think number one, I start with telling patients you don't need the Mercedes-Benz of blood pressure cuffs. You don't need the fanciest one. You need one that's accurate, and it should be an upper arm. They tend to be more accurate than the wrist blood pressures. So you get an upper arm cuff. What you should do at some point is bring it to your internist, your cardiologist, or your kidney doctor. Bring it in to make sure it's accurate, because that is the single most important thing. And as we talked about earlier, you don't need to do this every day. 3-4 times a week, varying times. Keep the log and keep a trend. What is helpful is if a machine has a memory effect, because many of them do. Some of them are very fancy now with Bluetooth, and you can get a graph set up. But the idea is to get the trends. You know, there's something called a 24-hour ambulatory monitoring that some doctors set up. They're nice, but they give you one day. What we're trying to do is to treat the patient over the course of your life. So we want trends. We want a 2-3-4 week trend and get you into the habit, like you said, of owning the blood pressure a little bit so you have a sense of when things go up and down.
All right. I have a call online, please.
Hello?
Ann, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I have a question about diastolic blood pressure. My systolic is usually 120, up to 130, 140, but diastolic is anywhere from 48 to 55, 60. Is there any significance of the diastolic being low?
So it's a our topic today is high blood pressure, and it sounds like, if anything, you're bordering on low blood pressure. So in general, if it's are you on medications to lower your blood pressure?
No, I take metoprolol because I have tachycardia.
Right. So metoprolol is a beta blocker, which is a blood pressure med. It can contribute to low blood pressure. So the bottom number, we like to see the bottom number below 90. When it gets extremely low, sometimes it can cause symptoms. And so what I would say, if you're feeling fine, I really would not focus on that. I probably would discuss it with your doctor and say, you know, this is the blood pressures that you're recording. And then also see what it is in the office, because sometimes getting that low blood pressure monitored on a machine can be a little bit challenging. And having someone doing it manually with a stethoscope, you can get a more accurate number on the bottom number.
Yeah, it's always high at the doctor's office.
The bottom number is always higher.
Higher, and also the systolic is higher.
Yeah, yeah. It is the limitation of some of the home blood pressure machines, and I think that it still does support going to see a doctor on a regular basis, bringing the machine with you to see if there's a correlation, and a stethoscope still remains one of the best ways to measure blood pressure. So, again, I would remain reassured that's probably a safe number. And, again, discuss it with your doctor when you bring your machine in on the next visit.
Sure. Thank you very much, doctor. All right.
Have a good day. Barbara?
Good morning. The reason I'm calling is about the procedure or operation called TVDR, I believe it's called, for aortic stenosis.
Right, so Barbara, you're talking about TAVR, which is
TAVR. I get the initials mixed up.
Yes, so I am an interventional cardiologist, and this is an integral part of my my world. So TAVR stands for transcatheter aortic valve replacement, and it's a procedure that is commonly being done now on people who have symptomatic aortic stenosis, which is a narrowing of the heart valve. And so in the past 4 years, it's become the treatment of choice, particularly for people who are older and may have medical problems. So TAVR, T-A-V-R, is something that can be used to treat a narrowed heart valve without opening the chest. The old days, it used to be an incision in your chest to put a new valve in, and now we're able to do it through a procedure going through the leg, like an angioplasty or a stent procedure.
Yes. Now, when you're 94, but in fairly good shape otherwise, is it dangerous?
As you get older, any procedure has increased risk. But the procedure actually was initially performed on people who were older. And so your number is not always the most important thing. It's not how old you are, but how you are when you're old. So if you're 94 in relatively good shape and have not feeling well, it is a procedure that could be really transformative in how you're feeling. So age is not a contraindication.
It isn't. Okay. And if the valve is a dime size, not a quarter size anymore, is that an indication that something must be done?
The most important thing is how you're feeling. And so the test that we use to make the measurements is called an echocardiogram or sonogram.
Yes.
And that will help determine the severity, and combined with how you're feeling, that would be the indication for fixing it. So symptoms are probably the most important driver for fixing a narrowed valve. And those symptoms would include shortness of breath, lightheadedness, generalized fatigue that's progressing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Have a good day, Barbara. Friend?
Can I go ahead?
Yes, friend.
Yes.
Good morning.
I had a Hashimoto's disease, and I had a thyroidectomy done. After thyroidectomy, my doctor told me to take thyroid pills, but my husband forgot to tell me. a couple of months later, I had a very severe gallbladder attack. I went to the hospital, and they did a sonogram. I have an adrenal tumor, which is on the right side 3.4, and on the left side 0.5. Now my blood pressure fluctuates. Sometimes it goes all the way to 233. And I'm on amiodarone, and it goes to 233, and then it goes to 90 over 59. It goes up and low.
So, friend, so, with Dr. Masani, this is really his expertise. I'm going to defer him. Navit, we have about less than a minute. You want to address friend's question?
So I'm going to tell you right now, it sounds like you're going through a lot, and you want to make sure that you get to the right doctors here. Probably need a kidney blood pressure specialist and an endocrinologist to see if the blood pressure is coming from the things in the adrenal gland that you described. Because there are a couple of different conditions and hormone releases that the adrenal gland can do that can raise your blood pressure. Those are certainly dangerous numbers, and they're numbers that you want to address, I would say, you know, like tomorrow morning, I would say, get in touch with your doctors. Certainly, if you have any symptoms, if you have any chest discomfort or trouble breathing, you want to address this very emergently at that point.
Okay. Navit, friend, hopefully it's a very complex question. Again, hopefully in that short amount of time, Masani
could... said if you take out the tumor, which you'll die on the table. Is it true? If I die on a table? The right adrenal is 3.4 centimeters. Left adrenal is 0.4.
I apologize that, again, you have a very unusual, complex problem. And, again, I don't mean to cut you short, but the show is coming to an end. And, please address this with your doctors. Thank you, everybody, for listening today. Our call-ins and Dr. Masani. High blood pressure, the silent killer. Please take ownership of your blood pressure, your lifestyle, your salt intake, your exercise. All these things can impact and prolong your life. We're reducing heart disease and stroke because of blood pressure control. The future is bright, and I think that we're getting better. We're taking care of ourselves. This is Dr. Kevin Marzo from NYU Winthrop, hosting for Dr. Katz today. Thank you.
WABC, New York.